Good day. All sites are now on the conference line in a listen-only mode. You've been joined by your conference moderator today, Joyce Uhurth. Go ahead.
Thank you, and welcome to our conference call series on enhancing services in natural environments. This series of calls is sponsored by the OSEP Community of Practice on Part C Settings in Natural Environments. That's facilitated by the National Early Childhood TA Center and the Southeast Regional Resource Center. Our team of facilitators includes myself and then Linda Pletcher at NECTAC and Elizabeth Jackson at CERC, who together did the real lion's share of the work on these calls. Additionally, Delia Serpa at CERC and Tal Black and Sharon Ringwall at NECTAC and the technology support at both NECTAC and CERC have been contributing to this call series. Julianne Woods is our presenter today, so I believe we're ready to move ahead with Linda and ask Linda Pletcher to please introduce Julianne.
It's my privilege to introduce Dr. Julianne J. Woods, full professor, director of clinical and distance education, Department of Communication Disorders at Florida State University in Tallahassee. Julianne started out her life as a direct service provider both in speech pathology and early intervention and said even now she still does direct services as well as all of her responsibilities with teaching and research. Her education and degrees are from the University of Oregon and the University of Northern Iowa. In her position at Florida State, she's teaching and conducting research in early communication development, intervention, family-centered services, and intervention in natural environments, and directing research and demonstration projects in family-guided routines, intervention with young children, and autism spectrum disorders. Some of the grants and projects that she is involved with, many of you have heard the names, but and on the website you have direct links to tactics outreach, family-guided routines-based intervention, which is focusing on intervention in natural environments for young children with disabilities and their caregivers, and an additional collaborative projects now include Positive Beginnings, which is a project of national significance addressing the in-service needs of caregivers and service providers working with children with disabilities in natural environments, and another project called Early Social Interaction, which is a model demonstration project for young children at risk for autism. All of these projects are directly linked from the URL for the call today, so you can read more and get more information about those projects. I think Julianne brings us a passion for early intervention in the field and lots of personal experience over the years of working with children providers and research projects. So Julianne, thank you very, very much for doing this for us today.
You're very welcome. I am very glad that I have technical assistance from my technical assistance folks to help make sure that I don't just get talking and wander down the road. So we're going to count on Joyce and Linda to make sure that we all know where I'm headed. And the challenge to them will be if they can figure it out. And it's very nice to be here with you. I wish we were together so that we could have conversations and really talk about the challenges that we're facing with what we're trying to do, but more importantly to share the kinds of stories and successes that we're having that make us all keep coming back for more in this field of early intervention. I've been asked to follow a format which I will do my very best to do, and so we've completed slide one. We now know that I'm Julianne Woods, and we're going to move on to slide two. And what I'd like to start off with in this is then taking a look at what are some of the words that are important to try to sift through as we look at the variety of natural environments models that you're going to have the opportunity to hear about. And I'm going to try to emphasize where are the similarities as well as where are there might be some differences that would be applicable to the populations that you're serving that might match your service providers and might meet the needs of your families. You're going to have a great opportunity over the next few weeks to hear about the diversity that is beginning to evolve in our practices and our processes for serving families in natural environments. And what's really great about our field is I've been so fortunate to work with a variety of folks who really dig in and look at it from different perspectives. And so I'm pleased to have the opportunity to share what we're trying to do here at Florida State to meet some of the unique needs of families in our catchment area, but more importantly, to share with you some of the ways that it's evolved from practices and programs in other states in which I've had the great opportunity to work with collaborators. So we're going to start off with some definitions. Family guided is a term that we've used since I was at the University of Oregon. And it's really a way of looking at our role as providers of making sure that we provide families with the information that they need, that they can guide their own decision-making process. We respect them as the decision-makers, but it's our role as providers to make sure that they have the information that they need in the formats that are going to make the most sense to them, and make it meaningful to them so that they can make the decisions about their child in the services. It's a way of providing flexible options for their participation. There is no one way that we expect families to participate at any period of time in the process. It evolves as their needs change, and we provide flexible options for them. And again, I think the term describes itself well. They're guiding the process with us. Routine-based is a term that you'll hear a lot, and it may vary a little bit in what it means to different presenters. We use the word routine because after doing interviews with families in three different states, routine was a word that made sense to them. And so our definition of routine means two things to us. It's one, that it's the combination of the kinds of activities, play, events, and obviously caregiving routines that occur within the life of a family. And for us, it's also a framework that we try to help families begin to understand to help them do a little structure into their teaching for their child if their child needs it to learn. So we look at the different types of routines. We use what we call a consultative model and emphasize the importance of adult learning strategies for diverse learners. One of the strategies that we rely heavily on is problem solving with the caregivers to identify what are their preferred ways of learning, whether they want to demonstrate with us, if they want us to provide them with different types of learning materials, if they want to videotape, if they want to talk, if they want us to show them. So we look at a variety of different strategies, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that later on, because that may be one of the more unique features of the model, is our attention to how we help the caregivers learn about routines and their child's learning. We use the word embedded intervention as a broad concept that integrates teaching for the child within the construct of their day. We look at some very specific goals and objectives that have been identified on their IFSP. And so for us in FGRBI, we're looking at embedding by the caregiver within their everyday routines and play, using their materials, the kinds of routine sequences that they like to do, and the strategies that work the best for them in those activities. So as we move on to then the next slide, key practices in FGRBI, these are the three components of pretty much what we do in whatever activity we're having, whether it's gathering and giving information, whether it's the evaluation assessment process or the IFSP process. We rely heavily on these three key practices. The first one being gathering and giving. We recognize that for every piece of information that we ask from families, we should be giving information back to families. So we try to look at it as a turn-taking opportunity to engage with the family. We listen to their stories, their accomplishments, and their concerns, and then we try to explain why we need this information and what it's going to help them with and what their role is in early intervention and why that's important. We look at examples that we can give them in their routines and how that applies into developmental knowledge parents don't know about child development. I'm a brand new grandma. I have a new granddaughter who's 2 weeks and 3 days old, but who's counting here. And I'm amazed again at just watching her and all the things that I'm beginning to remember that I had forgotten. And this has been my field of study for years. And so I think that we have to recognize that there are many people out there who are delightful parents who love and nurture their children but may not know all the developmental pieces of information that we know and ways that we can help them learn about that information in concrete routines and activities when they're doing those things is going to be very helpful to them. So we do a lot of gathering and giving throughout every component of our the whole early intervention process. In addition, we spend a lot of time observing families, seeing what they're already doing so we can capitalize on that, not asking them to step back and learn something that they already know or repeat something that they've been doing better than we could anyway. But then we do model for them by what we call joining in versus taking over, and that's looking at how can we help share some new information that might make it a little bit easier for the child. What adaptations could we do, or how could we add a few more opportunities to practice? The other piece that we do that families have told us has been very helpful, and that is looking at strategies for problem solving that help support their decision making, helping them be able to weigh the pros and cons of different routines, different strategies, different kinds of activities for their child, and then making sure that they have the resources they need to be able to implement those decisions that they make. So those are the three key practices that you will hear about throughout my presentation. A few years ago, Carl Dunst and his colleagues published a manuscript in Infants and Young Children that looked at ways of describing the different models of natural environment intervention. And so I took those three categories that he described in that manuscript and tried to apply them to what we call FGRBI, or Family Guided Routines-Based Intervention. And when we look at the context in which we apply our interventions, we use all the natural learning opportunities, and we help families understand about natural learning opportunities and how they can incidentally teach a wide variety of important skills for their child. And then on top of that, we add embedded interventions in the kinds of routines that the family identify as preferred for them, or if their child is having some problems, we'll look at some problem routines as well.
That's slide 4, isn't it, Julianne?
Yes, it is.
Thank you.
I missed it, Joycey. Thank you.
That's all right.
You're
We're
on
doing
the
it.
Ball. Very good. Slide 4. So we look at a combination approach. We really encourage the families to make the most out of every day. But in order to make sure that the child has adequate opportunities to learn a specific skill that's been prioritized by the family as important, we will then work with them to embed within their routines and activities, extra opportunities to practice that with a variety of support so that the child can become more independent. As I mentioned, our activity types are ones that are identified by the family. They're prioritized. We look at first picking out the activities and routines that the family and the child prefer and that are motivating. I think we all know we're more likely to do something and continue to do it if it's something we enjoy doing. We also know that the more you enjoy doing it, the more opportunities you're going to have to practice. So by picking out child-preferred and motivating routines and activities, we're going to increase the frequency of occurrence, increasing then the number of opportunities so that we can help enhance the child's learning. We also look across classes of routines. And we look at caregiving routines. These are things that have to happen in the life of the child. There's going to be some food going in and some diapers and pottying coming out. There's going to be some car travel or on the subway. There's going to be lots of play. There's going to be trips into the community to get the groceries, to get gas for the car, to pick up the other siblings or relatives. Hopefully there's some recreation activities. And then sometimes there's just lots of good music and games and social activities or book reading. So we look at different kinds of routines and help families choose across the classes the routines that they're the most likely to practice with their child in, that they're the most comfortable. But we also are trying to look at the most efficient way to teach family members to work with their child, knowing that if we only work in one kind of activity like play, which is something that I think we've been guilty of in early intervention for years, and that's I'm going to teach you how to play with your child, or I'm going to play with your child and model for you how to play with your child, and then I'm going to tell you what you could do at bath time and what you could do in the kitchen and what you could do in car travel. But I'm not going to really show you how to do that stuff. I'm just going to tell you how to do it. We look at making sure families have the information and the resources and also then the supports from us that they can feel comfortable and confident working in a variety of different kinds of routines. And our delivery of instruction really is by the family member or the caregiver. We look at our visitations with the families and to the child care centers when we work with different caregivers there as primarily the consultation to problem solve, to plan, to look at new goals, to monitor progress. And so the real delivery of instruction occurs by others, the family primarily, and with us providing support to them. So that is sort of how FGRBI breaks down using Carl's construct. So as we look at the next slide then, I wanted to explain a little bit about why we made some of these choices for how we were going to go about doing things. And we've tried to use families as our rationale for what we do. Families have shared in many different materials what they really want in early intervention, and one of the resources that I'm sharing with you comes from the 0-3 newsletter and is on their webpage. And families have said multiple times that they want to work together to learn about their child. They want to have a picture of their child that is in their own familiar and functional settings. They want to be able to participate with their child in meaningful activities. And they want the information and supports that help them make the decisions that are going to be the most beneficial to their child and their family. Based on what families want, then, we've tried to adapt our model. But we've also continued to listen to families about what are some of the things that they're getting within their early intervention services. And so if you look at slide 6, what you'll see there is some comments that we've picked up from families across the country, but primarily in the regions in which we're working the most closely with programs about what's still happening to them. And I don't think some of these comments are going to surprise you too much. I think you're going to recognize them as problems that you may still run into in your program, or they're very definitely a problem within your program, because it's difficult to really revamp what we've done through a new lens of providing the services within the context of the family with them as the providers and partners with us in the service provision. So some of the things I wanted to point out that families have said that we've tried to use to guide our process is that families have identified that they don't really know what natural environments are, and they don't understand why things have changed. And I think that that's probably some questions that we've all had ourselves and we're still trying to find the answers to. And my guess is there's a few of you sitting out there listening on the phone saying, I still don't know the answers to that. Well, I feel very good about what we're doing within the context of natural environments, and I'm really glad we're doing it. But it was a real aha moment for me, you know, 3 or 4 years ago when I realized that families didn't know what we were doing or why we were doing it. And so they had a very hard time figuring out what their role was supposed to be. So within our model. We spend time literally helping families learn and understand what is a natural environment, but more importantly, why is it important to them and how does that affect what they're going to do with us within the context of early intervention. I think it's important to recognize families are confused by a lot of the words we use, and I'm guilty of that myself. When I talk about routines, it's very important for me to then stop and say, the reason we want to talk about routines is because these occur at a high frequency. They're things you have to do, so it doesn't mean you're doing extra work with your child or doing homework. But if you as a family have activities that you do around stories and books and songs, that's great. We can use those too, because it's all about what you prefer to do and how often you do these routines. So what I did with you was go beyond just saying, tell me about your day, give me all these routines that you do, and try to relate it to what kinds of information the family may need so that they understand why we're doing it. Families aren't used to this kind of a model. If they have any experience at all, it's probably been themselves within the context of an educational model or a medical model if they've been involved with their child with healthcare problems. Or concerns, or if they've been in a program previously, it may have been more of a medical-based model. But what we're presenting to them really isn't either. It's sort of a hybrid and emphasizes their role and them as the decision makers. So I think there is a lot that we need to do to help families really understand why it is that we're doing what we're doing. So I've had the pleasure of working with some programs across the country looking at their materials. What do we share with families about our program and how do we introduce natural environments to them? What's in our public awareness information? What's in our first brochures? I think probably all the presenters are going to share with you helping the family understand natural environments starts with the very first phone call. I think we have to recognize, you know, it needs to continue with the next phone call, the next home visit, the next site visit, whatever we do, and recognize that understanding about natural environments isn't a one- or two-shot deal. It's an ongoing process for it to make sense to most of us, as well as particularly for the families who are focusing on getting services for their child. So as we take a look at that list, I don't think there's going to be anything there, like I said, that surprises you. One that I still hear from families is that there's still a lot of playing with toys going on, and yet there's talk about routines, which is new and that's wonderful, but the family members don't quite know what to do within those kinds of caregiving routines. They hear about them, but they're kind of left on their own, and again, within our model, we truly try to help families within a variety of different routines. So let's take a look at specifically what are some of the ways that we apply the practices that I mentioned, the gathering and giving, the observing and modeling, and the problem solving in the different components of the process. And I've already told you that parents really don't know what natural environments is, and we can all laugh about that as we're trying to figure it out, too. Within our model, we try, again, to provide the families information.
We're on slide 7, is that correct?
Yes, we are. Good
Thank
job.
You.
Okay, we're on slide 7. We try to, I didn't move mine either, so I'm in trouble. If I, you know, that's going to help. We try to help families see what we're doing. And when we help families see, we use a variety of different strategies. I'm really going to freak you out here, I think. I'm going to ask you to, if you've got PowerPoints printed out, look at slide 13. And if you don't have them printed out, click ahead to slide 13, and I'm going to share a little bit of that with you, and then we're going to go back to 7 again, just to confuse the issue. In slide 13, we have a list, a more expanded list than what was on slide 7, that are some of the strategies that we use to help families see what we're talking about in the gathering and giving. So you're going to hear across these weeks about having conversations with families, asking the right questions, and helping them begin to see their role and how they can participate. In addition to that, we're going to offer them the opportunity to watch some videos of other families. We have made little snippets, and these are not fancy videos, let me tell you. These are families talking a little bit about what they learned about natural environments, or it's a family with showing all the different kinds of routines and activities that they work with their child in. Sometimes it's a family just showing what they're doing with their child, and the children will have similar types of disabilities. But we try to let, if we can't bring parent to parent, or the family themselves would not feel comfortable with a parent to parent, many families are very comfortable watching a short video, and that can be a great illustration. And I think we, in our technology era, should look at how we might be able to use video more effectively to help parents learn about the concepts that seem so abstract and when we just talk about them. My guess is much of what I've said to you, no matter how hard I've tried to make it black and white, is pretty gray in some of the areas. Things I've said that I thought were pretty specific may be very general to you, and you're not really sure what the point is I'm trying to make. That point is illustrated by the fact that we are all very different kinds of learners. Some of us pick it up auditorily, and we anchor it to previous experiences we have. Some of us are visual learners. If they've seen it or read it, we've got it, and all that auditory stuff just hums around us. Some of us capture it quickly. Others capture it much more slowly, methodically, need to think about it, need to hear it two or three times. This is reality, and our families are an awful lot like us. Nobody learns the same way. And yet when I talk to programs about a variety, you know, how do you introduce this and how do you gather and give that initial sets of information, there's often a standard packet. We're driven by forms, and that was one of the things that families had said previously to us, is that the process appears to be driven by getting the forms completed. Now, you're all going to say, well, that's because it is driven by forms we have to get completed, and we have a 45-day timeline, and you know, we've got it. And you're absolutely right. I don't disagree with you. So some of our accountability requirements make it a little bit more difficult to be very oriented to the adult learning needs of the families with whom we work. But we do try. So we try to make everything short and snippets. And so if you want to go back to slide number seven again, I'll try to stay going in process again. But I did want to just illustrate to you some of the different ways that we try to bring adult learning into perspective from the very beginning, recognizing that our effectiveness as a consultant with the family is making a connection to them as a learner. So we talk about what is a natural environment. We have some handouts that I'll share with you as we flip through the web page, some strategies that we've used to help them understand why is it important to talk about routines, why are we asking them all these questions about their life and what they do during the day and the evening and on weekends and what their expectations for their child are. So again, the key word here is for every piece of information that we gather, we try to give information, our explanations of why, and more importantly, illustrations of what they're doing that we want to enhance. So if mom's holding the baby and burping her, and the baby gives a big belch, you'll notice all my examples here are going to be related to little babies, because I have my granddaughter now, and she spit up on me, and I'm wearing it with great pride. She's, you know, looking at, after she burps, the baby burps, mom looks at baby and puts her into a face-to-face position and says, wow, that was a big one. That is a perfect time in the middle of your interview to explain that is what we're talking about. That's a, a concrete example of within this routine, you're providing her with an opportunity to see you, to hear your voice, to be encouraged with what she does. And what does baby do? She smiles back at you. These are the kinds of routines and activities that we're talking about and why we need to know what you like to do with your child, because those are the good learning opportunities. So instead of just asking all the questions, you know, tell me about your day, what do you like to do, what does your child like to do with you, inserting a concrete example for the family at that moment that it makes perfect sense, and not let our forms drive us, even if we don't get all the blanks filled in, to take that, what we called when we were working with preschoolers, the teachable moment, but not for the child, but for the adult, to help them see in day-to-day life how important they are. On to the next slide. I'm going to remember here. When we're doing an evaluation and assessment, again, we continue to use that gathering and giving, observing and modeling, and problem-solving and decision-making process, and I tried to outline it a little bit here for you. And as I talked before, we have a lot of conversations with the families, and we do a lot of listening to what they say. We also observe them. My example with the burping would be an example of one of the routines that we would have observed with the family. So that gives us an idea to see what occurs within the family's routines. What do they do? What does the parent already do, so that we don't back up and try to teach them some skills or some strategies that they already have. We also use those opportunities to complete our child-focused assessment. This may be one of the differences in our model versus some of the others that you hear about. We do complete a developmental curriculum-based assessment across all domains. Most states requires some sort of a child measure. We do this in a combination of observation and family report information. We believe it helps us in that relationship building with the family, because it gives us something concrete, again, to share information about that's very much on the family's mind. That's why they brought us in there, as one of their concerns. And so we listen to them and we share with them what their child is doing in the context of those meaningful activities that are occurring. For older kids beyond the burping, we ask the family to choose 2 to 3 different things that they would like to do with us. And if they are having a hard time coming up with ideas, that's our job then to help them with some problem solving. You know, is it a good time to have a snack? What would you really be typically be doing now? Would you be watching TV? Would you be playing with your child? Would you be doing your laundry? What are the things you're doing, and we can just join you? And if the family still is unsure and doesn't have a lot to offer, we have to remember we're helping them learn about what their role is. So I'm not at all puzzled when families don't have a lot of answers for me or appear very quiet initially. I offer them choices. Well, we could do this or we could do that. We could do some stories. We could do, a snack. We could make some, have some juice. We could make a picture. What would be the most fun for you with your child? And letting them have the final decision what we're going to do within the assessment. That's a whole lot different assessment than our traditional, I have my PLS kit if I'm doing a language eval, or I have my Battelle bag and I've got my toys. It's a very fluid type of assessment within the context of the routines using the family's materials and activities. It also requires you to be a little more flexible in how you do your assessments, recognizing that it may not go quite the way you had it planned in your head as you drove up to the door. And also, the fun part of it is no two of them are ever alike, and you get some great ideas from each child that you can take to the next child and family's home for doing the assessments. I wish I could show you some video at this point, because that would help you see that we gather the information that's very meaningful to the family, and it also really gets the parents involved very early, because we're helping them participate with their child as we want them to in intervention. And parents have told us that it seemed as though we brought in this natural environment stuff after they had already watched us do some pretty standard professional assessments. So why did it suddenly change? We're trying to bring what we want it to look like in intervention to the very first steps with the evaluation and assessment phase as well. Okay, deep breaths, and let's look at the next slide. And this one's going to come in components because I didn't take off the animation, and I apologize for that. But slide 9, observing routines, is one that helps us begin to shift our focus from professional-driven assessments on specific child skills to a teaching and learning partnership with the parent. So we're looking not just at the skills of the child, but we're really looking at that whole process of how learning occurs and how teaching occurs within that family dyad. And so this measure's looking at the dyad. We first observe the routine. So if you want to click on that and bring in the routine information, we look at what is it about this activity that is going to help utilize what we know about instructional sequences and good teaching to help support the child and the caregiver. We look at the child, but not whether they have fine motor skills or gross motor skills, but what are some of the processes that they use to make learning happen for them? Are they very attentive? Do they imitate? Do they anticipate what's going to happen next? Are they independent at all in their participation? Or are they more of a responder waiting for the parent's cues? We also then look at the caregiver. Are they a talker? And some caregivers talk through everything they do, and others are really pretty silent or talk about something different. Do they expect the child to participate, or is this a 20-second routine in which we get you a drink, give it to you, and that's all over, and minimal interaction that's occurring there? Do they read the child's cues? Do they encourage the child to participate, or are they almost preempting the child's participation? But importantly, then, we look at the dyad, and that's who's sitting where, how are they doing it, how do they work together? Do they take turns? What happens when the child doesn't understand what the parent wants, and what happens when the parent doesn't understand the child? How do they repair those interactions, or do they just stop and move on? So we look at this as an important piece of our evaluation and assessment process to get us ready for the intervention. And again, this is a real paradigm shift from looking specifically at the child's skills to looking now at what is the environment and the interaction between the caregiver and the child that enhances the learning to occur. With this information, we can then look at embedding much more effectively, because it's not just about what we're going to embed and what level of prompt we're going to use. We're really looking at the whole process. So we have found this to be very useful to us. It's not a form that you fill out. It's not a checklist, but it's really a series of questions and observations that really fine-tune us as service providers in our skills of knowing how to facilitate that interaction between the caregiver and child. And that leads me to the next slide, which comes from colleagues at the University of Illinois, Jeanette McCollum and Tweedy Yates, in their PeeWee project a few years back. And this is a visual that really helps me a great deal in remembering what my role is. As a service provider, it would be very easy for me to work directly with the child because, my God, I'm 159 years old now, and I've been doing this for at least 75 years. And I've worked with kids. I went into this profession to work with kids, and I'm sure there's a lot of you service providers out there who would agree with me that that was one of the most attractive things about being an early intervention service provider. And that was because we got to work with kids, and we got to help them and teach them things. So it would be very easy for us to draw an arrow from our role as a provider to the child, because that's pretty much what we were taught to do. In fact, I see that happening continuously in universities now, that we're still teaching providers to work with children. And I'm not saying that's wrong, but I'm saying that's not enough. We also took on in the more recent reauthorizations, the last couple of them, an increased knowledge of our role as facilitating the care providers and working with their kids, but also just in whole being family-centered, so that we spend more time working with care providers, supporting them, providing them with information. And so I think we could put that arrow pointing to the care providers and feel pretty comfortable too. So we would look at building a triangle between us as the provider and the child and the care provider. But Jeanette and Tweedy really helped me understand what I needed to be doing in this role by putting the arrows between the child and the care provider. They're the dyad. They're who are the ones who are doing the 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week type of interaction and intervention. And I'm there to support those interactions between the dyad. So I love to use this picture to remind myself, but also to help folks realize that we're there to support those interactions. And yes, that there's three of us, but it's not a triangle, it's a T-intersection, and that's what's really going to make the difference. When we begin our intervention phases, after the evaluation and assessment and the IFSP development, you'll see that we continue to use the same processes and practices. So we're still gathering and giving information. It never ends. Because as we gather new information, we have new information to share. And as the family learns more about their child's development and how they're going to affect change for their child, there's new goals to set. And so it's a never-ending vertical opportunity for us. We're always working together. We watch.
We're on 11, is that correct?
Yes, we are. We're on slide 11, okay. So we're continuing with that process, too, of observing, seeing what the family's doing, sharing with them some new strategies. Many families want us to sit side-by-side and model with them. Other families may feel more comfortable doing it themselves and letting us just talk or make some suggestions. We take turns. Again, remembering that there is no one exact way you'll do it with each family, but adapt to what it is that they want to do. Some families demonstrate back for us and show us and want us to be there to see what they're doing. Others are more reserved and would prefer to watch us and do some things with us and maybe not show us entirely what they're going to do, but to problem solve it with us and talk it through and then practice when we're not there. I don't think that we have to see everybody practice things. We're not there to give lectures and then to have a 10-point checklist where we make sure they can do it just the way we did. It's an evolving process, and it depends a great deal on the relationship. So we give, again, that list of choices that I shared with you on an upcoming slide of how we interact with the families. But we always make sure before we leave that we plan what we're going to do the next week. We problem solve what might happen, what could go wrong, what do we think is going to go right, what do we want to work on the next time. So again, that problem solving and decision making occurs within every interaction that we have with family. Excuse me. And many of the print materials that are on our website will support these concepts. We're going to go to the next slide, number 12, while I take a drink. This is again from Tweedy and Jeanette at the University of Illinois from Pee Wee Project. And these are the 6 steps we use in the consulting process. These are very nicely laid out in a manuscript that I reference in an upcoming slide. And I would encourage you all to review that manuscript. I use it in my teaching because these are specific things that we can all learn to do. Consulting is such an ambiguous term. It's, again, so abstract that when we talk about, well, I'm going to come in service colleagues when we're working with them, of some things that they can learn to do that will enhance the caregiver's ability to work confidently with their child and competently with their child for their child to have success. So this is the model that we use in our program. On to the next slide, which you've already seen once. These are some of the techniques that we use to increase the caregiver's competence. We started off not being quite so specific, but as we worked with more and very diverse adult learners, we decided to start developing a menu of strategies that worked, and then we began asking families what they would like and what they felt was most effective with them. And as I mentioned before, families have different learning styles, so do we. And so we continue to add to this list throughout our material development with different families that we work with. We've had a great opportunity here in the last year to work with a variety of different international families. The current project that we have that we're working on, we've been able to work with cohorts of families so that we can begin to get some information that might be very applicable to families who are speaking English as a second language, families who all have children with autism spectrum disorders. Again, those are very general categories. Every family is different. I want to emphasize that. But we're trying to look at what might be some methods that we could use to strengthen how we share information with families and how we help them in the problem-solving process become more effective decision makers. So these are the strategies that are currently on our menu, and as I said, we will continue to add to them. If you look at them and want to compare them to some of the other models of natural environments, you're going to see these look much more teachy-oriented. And I came to this the hard way. I wasn't able to really say what was working with families. I have, again, been a longtime service provider, and that's still the most important role to me. But as I started wearing the hat that says researcher on it more often to gather the evidence about the effectiveness of this approach, I discovered that we needed to have a little bit more specificity, and we had to have something that I could define more clearly to the service providers who were working with me so that they knew what I was talking about and could do what I was doing. I also listened again to the families, and many of the families shared with me some of the same frustrations that you're probably feeling now. I don't know exactly what you're talking about. If I could see it, if you could show me, if I could see it on a video, if you would practice it with me, that would be great. For others, the thought of having a handout was very useful to them. I know myself, I'll take the handout home. I may never look at it again, but that's my choice if I don't want to look at it again. I at least have it if I want to go back and reference it, and sometimes I do, and sometimes I don't. So as you take a look at what strategies are you going to use, I just want to reinforce to you that there are many diverse adult learners. We all look at it very differently. There are some things that work for more of us than others, and there are some things that are going to be unique to each individual child and family that we have to take a look at. If we ignore the needs of the adult learners, there are going to be a lot of families out there that we just never reach. And those are going to be the ones that I will hear about in my workshops, and people will say, well, you don't have those families that you work with. I think we all have families that are easy to engage. I think we all have families who are much more difficult to engage. I prefer to look at it from a standpoint of adult learners. I have students in my classes that I know snoozed through every lecture, but were brilliant on the exams, and I had to wonder what it was. It certainly wasn't anything I said. It might have been the reading material. It might have been the activities that they participated in. It might have been the opportunity to watch some of the videos and see it. If I am facilitating adult learning of the caregivers with whom I'm working with, I have to recognize that that's one of my goals, and I have to plan for it. So we do plan activities that will be facilitative to the parents. So we look at it as a dual role. My job is to help the caregiver be able to help their child. And so that means I have to know about child development and interventions as well as adult learning. So we may be more specific in some of the things that we try to do in our model. We'll often watch videos together and talk about them. We will keep track of data together. What are the routines that were working? What did you do? Families told me in one of my last projects that I very often ask them to collect data, but I rarely ever made them feel as though it was real important because I didn't want to impose on them. I think as I get older, I'm learning that if I'm going to ask somebody to do something like a family member, I need to let them know it's okay if you don't get it done, but it's going to help us if you do. And again, I think I'm learning the lesson that by giving out information about why it's important and what difference it's going to make, then the family can make the decision whether or not they can do it, and how much they can do and when. And that has to be then their decision that they make. But they have to have all the information before they can make the right, the decision that's best for them. All right, the next two slides, number 14 and number 15, are what we call the key indicators. And this is actually a checklist that as providers we fill out occasionally, and then occasionally one of us will go with the other one to help give feedback about how we're doing. And this is a downloadable off the website if you're interested in it. But there's 10 things on these two slides, numbers 14 and 15, 5 things to look for and 5 things to listen for that we believe exemplifies our model. Things like making sure that we focus on the dyad, not just the child or the caregiver, using the family's toys and materials, making sure that we spend some time observing the caregiver and the child in their routines, and joining in with them rather than changing it. There's 101 ways to change a diaper. There's 50 different ways to get a drink. And we don't have to do it the way we do it. We know what works for us. Our job in this model is to learn what's going to work the best for that dyad. It has nothing to do with how we make it right. How do we help modify that routine for the family with the least amount of modifications, being as minimally intrusive as we can be, that so it still fits their family values, the kinds of things that are meaningful and important to them, and so that it doesn't become therapy. So I think that the fewest modifications we make means that it's the least amount of trying to make them into what we are. We also look to see if there's a variety of different routines within each of our visits to the daycares or to the family's home. So again, going back to that different classes of routine, are we doing more than playing? When we listen for that problem solving rather than making lecture recommendations. We listen for sharing information about why things are important, how does learning occur, what are the wonderful things the parent is doing right already, what's effective, and how is the child learning from that. We try to connect what's happening now in these routines and activities back to the family's priorities. What do they put on the IFSP, making sure that they see the connection and that it's not just nice fun things to do, but that it's what they asked us to do. And that also gives us a real reality check. Is this what the family still wants us to do? And we're always striving to meet the needs of the adult learner as well as the child in the learning context. Some of the supporting evidence that I wanted to share with you.
Julianne, yes? We have probably another 5 or so minutes.
Okay, I'm on time.
You're doing excellent.
Thank you. I needed that reinforcement and encouragement, Joycey. I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
You know, you guys, this is harder than if there was 200 of you in front of me.
Yes.
Much harder. Some of my favorite materials that I use for model development are listed here. There's a variety of ones that have really been important to us, of course, over time. And the most important references that I have are the families with whom I work. And so much of our model is based on feedback from the families with whom we work. And I'm so fortunate to work with a variety of collaborators in Kansas, with Dave and the Southeast Kansas Birth to Three program years ago, but continuing to get, you know, connected with them, and many different programs in Georgia and Texas giving me some feedback on what's working, what's not working. Families here in Florida, and I'm looking forward to participating with some families in a project in Chicago with Chris Salisbury, and I just got finished with a project with the folks at Juniper Gardens. So I'm so fortunate to be able to get a variety of input from very diverse and different families about what's working and what's not working, that I can't emphasize to you enough to simply have those conversations with families. How do you feel about this? What concerns you? What do you like about this? What makes a difference? What did we do that really seemed to help you get it, get the picture? And when did we get that picture? I've also listed a couple of more data-based articles that one's coming out soon and the other one we hope to have coming out soon. And we will continue to have more publications in this area now that I have wonderful colleagues who won't let me just ramble on forever. But Shubha Kashinath and Howard Goldstein have been essential to getting me to count things and organize things in a research fashion. And so I can't thank them enough, and I look forward to having more opportunities to share additional evidence with you in the future. One quick one, since I've been emphasizing with you how we emphasize in the model what caregivers want and what caregivers need. So if you look at slide 17, the results of one of the studies that we've completed, again, these were with families of children with autism. What were the things that made the most difference to them in helping them work with their child effectively? And they felt that the time that we spent problem solving with them was the single most important strategy that we used with them. They also liked watching other parents using strategies and routines and how they worked with their child. They liked having discussions with us as partners about what strategy might work, what routine would be a good one to practice in, or how many different routines, what did the child like to do. Again, it's another opportunity for families' voice to be heard. They liked talking about the data, which I found fascinating because, again, it was one more aha moment for me that it's not too intrusive to ask parents to take data when the data matters to them about their child, when they've identified what they're taking data about and where they're going to take the data and what difference it's going to make. And the other piece for these families were having some visuals, some handouts, some things to put on the wall to remind them of what they were trying to do, some cues and simple things that helped them be able to remember. And this was important to me because, you know, I've been in college, I think, all my life, and many of you have had, you know, 4 to 6 years of formal training. We're asking parents to do things that we've picked up over the course of years of training formally and then informally with workshops and reading and manuscripts. And we want families to pick it up in 1 or 2 weeks. And if they don't pick it up, then we think, oh, they're not doing anything between our visits. They're just not working with me. And the reality of it is, you know, we're asking them to learn a great deal of information that is very foreign to them in a very short period of time. And we need to look at strategies to support them in feeling confident that they can do this. And so I will lead you then to the last page of the presentation. Well, the next one is my reading list, but the last page of the presentation is number 19. And that leads us to two websites where all of the materials that we're currently using are available for you to download. And I'm going to just real quickly walk you through those sites before we start with questions. The tactics model, and if you're on a computer, you can click it and look at it if you want to. But the tactics website has a couple of things I'd like to point out for you. If you go down the left-hand column, if you're looking at it, there is a button there that says Family Stories. And on the Family Stories, we also have how we've used some of the forms with different families and a couple of video clips that might help you see the model in action. The Facets website isn't listed there, but on the Facets website, we have additional Family Stories and more downloadable materials. And the Facets website address is on, I think, the page that talks about me, I think. Is that where it is, Joycey?
Yeah, it's on the page that supports this call, Julianne, with your
terrific
name. And it's hot linked to the Facets.
All right, very good. You guys are so efficient. You made this, you know, you made a person who's totally disorganized, you know, as smooth as you can make me. I don't know. So anyway.
You're pretty smooth, Julianne.
Yeah, I have no clue what I've said, but I hope somebody can, you know, say it was worth it. Anyway, on the FGRBI page, which is our research page, and so it's a little bit different than the training materials. So, again, I want to just have you, if you're with your computer, click on the button, the FGRBI model. And if you're not with your computer, go back to the FGRBI page, because that's where a lot of the handouts are uploaded for you. A couple I'd like to point out are some of the ones that we use that help families learn about what are natural environments, what are routines. We have some stories there for families. We have some handouts that we walk through the families with so they can begin to make them match their own. So many of the handouts that we have are written about other families. So we have some things that have literally fill-ins where the family can write in where do they go, what are the kinds of activities they do when they go there, what are some of the outcomes that their child could be working on when they're there. Then we have some about routines that help them identify what is the sequence that they like to follow in their routine. When do they repeat it? So they can begin to look at building in an infrastructure for their child to learn within embedded intervention. We have some home visit notes, the way we do home visits, and additional resources there. So I would refer you to those. Again, these are the ones we're currently using in the research-based project. The training materials are on the Tactics and Facets websites. If you need anything else, there is a button under the staff on all those pages to Katrina Kripe, and she can help you access whatever it is that's there that you think might be useful. You know, I would love to have feedback. And with that, I will turn it back to the people who are going to move us into the next phase. Joycey?
Yes, we're here.
Okay. I just heard a funny noise.
I did too.
That's not a good sound.
Nate, are you with us? Nate?
You know, I think I've just been talking to you guys this whole hour.
Don't even say that.
There's nobody there.
Oh, that's
let's see.
Odd. Let me go.
Could you explain to the participants how to queue in?
Yes. Thank you. At this time, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star and one on your touch tone phone. If you'd like to withdraw your question at any time or if it isn't answered, you can press the pound sign. Once again, to ask a question, please press star and one on your touch tone phone. We'll pause while we wait for sites to register for questions.
Well,
we do have a question from Diane Otten. Go ahead, please.
Hi. First of all, I thought it was really very interesting and useful information. As a parent and a parent advocate, it made an awful lot of sense to me. However, I guess my question really is, how can we persuade professionals who, as you noted, learned how to do it differently and may have been doing it differently for years and years, and in their hearts believe it's better done the old way, and also reach families who, by the time they even get to early intervention, may have heard a lot of bad information from doctors and, you know, other people who aren't part of the early intervention system about what early intervention should be doing, focusing on a very kind of therapy medical model.
Well, now, that could take us a little while there, Diane, but anyway, I think our best resource for this are people like you and other families who have seen it both ways. One of the my favorite references, but I'm not sure I listed it, is an article that a family that I had the privilege of working with for a long time wrote. Lorna Mullis wrote a letter to family members in early intervention talking about her experiences, and she often travels with me and trains with me, and it's published in Young Exceptional Child, and it literally is a letter explaining to parents why the transition made so much sense to their family. Currently, we have a couple of family liaisons who we hook up with families joining us in services either via email, via phone calls, or through a little video clip where they talk about some of their experiences. They can go do visits if the family's interested in that. So we really think that the families themselves have to see what these models mean and what their role is, because it's very different than how they went to school. And you're absolutely right. They've heard stories and they've been told the way it should be from others who aren't comfortable with it. And in the same way, if families encourage our providers that they can do it, they want to do it, that's going to help our providers too. And I think we have to recognize this isn't a skill that they can unlearn and relearn in a 1 or 2 day workshop. It needs ongoing support from their program. It needs somebody that can do that triadic model with them, support them in learning how to work more effectively with a dyad. I think some of our training activities are totally useless unless they're provided with additional support, and it may be online. My favorite thing to do for training is to go with another provider, particularly one who thinks it's really stupid, and helping them see how easy it would be for them to make some of the changes, but then also helping them recognize how hard some of the changes are going to be. We can't legislate this change. And we can't just simply offer, 10 CEUs and think it's going to be different. It's a whole lifestyle process that requires people to really step back and look at what they're doing, examine what they're doing, and recognize that it's going to take some time and some support to make changes, both for the families and for the providers. But I think parents are an incredible resource. The parents helped me change. I continue to use them as a validator of what's working and what's not working. Sometimes I don't want to give up something they told me was pretty useless. I'll admit that. But after I've heard it 2 or 3 times, it's sort of like, yeah, even me can, I can change. And I think other providers will benefit from hearing from their families. We often don't want to ask families for that kind of feedback. Again, we don't want to intrude on families, but I have found my families to be, the most supportive of helping me do better, and recognizing they're helping other families in the future by spending some time and energy helping the providers do better. So it's not an easy answer, but then we also have to look at our training resources, getting more of the consultation to the direct providers and helping them in providing some refresher moments. We use that key indicators checklist, those 10 items I showed you. You know, we help each other in a situation that's challenging to us, give each other ideas and supports, because this is hard. So that was a long answer.
Thank you. I'm sorry. Our next question comes from Kristen Votava. Go ahead, please.
Yes. Hi. You talked a lot about diverse adult learning strategies, and one of the components in helping adults learn being video. And we're just wondering if you have a video library, if you make videos just to suit each particular situation, or how that works.
We're beginning to expand how we use video. We used to do video taping primarily for training. I've had many families participate with me and agree to be sort of what they used to laughingly call the guinea pigs, where we would then, you know, tape what we were doing so I could show it to other people and give them ideas. Again, that was helping providers learn how to do it, but what we've discovered is by parents watching other parents doing videos, they learn equally well, taking that whole adult learning to it. So what we've been doing is we ask families, can we videotape little clips of you? And videotape is cheaper. We can, you know, generate some fairly decent knockoff copies on our computers now. And we get permission from the families to share with other families. And again, if the family doesn't want to, we certainly don't. But I would encourage each of you in your programs to look at how can we pick up some different snippets of families for different purposes and share them within your program. I don't think there's anything commercially available that's nearly as powerful as watching another family in your region, whether you know them or not. But just seeing real people and knowing that they're not, you know, professionals or actors doing it, but real life people. And sometimes the quality doesn't have to be real good, or that I'm really bad. Whenever I take video, I move all the time because I constantly am in motion. And so mine are a little shaky, and maybe the seasickness aspect of it makes it better. I don't know. But it's a starting point. It's a talking point. So I'm very excited about all the potentials that video has to use for us, and would encourage you to look at collecting some of your own.
Thank you.
Thank you. Once again, if you have a question, please press star and one on your touch-tone phone. If you are listening on a speakerphone, I'd like to remind you to pick up the handset before you press star and one. We do have a question from Deborah Garmo. Go ahead, please.
Hi, I'm calling from Rhode Island. The question I have is, one is just a quick question. I lost track of what you were saying when you were talking about which website had the family resources.
You'll find them on all websites, and I should let you know, some of the handouts are the same, and they're posted on all three websites. But the FGRBI website, is the one that has the most recent materials that we're using in the research project.
Okay, and it would be under, like, related projects, that area?
No, it's under the model. FGRBI model is where all of the handouts are.
Great. And then one of, probably some of these handouts would help answer these questions, but a lot of what we're trying to do is to move, at the state level, is move service providers into, you know, if they're not using natural environments, then to justify as to why not. And so we're, you know, really trying to push this topic from the state level. However, what we're hearing a lot of is that families feel more comfortable and, you know, they'd rather be with other, you know, have their children with other children who are disabled, who have similar conditions or, you know, diagnosis. So how do you approach that with some of the education materials, or how is that approached with families?
I think we have to recognize families are comfortable, but they've probably not had other opportunities to be comfortable there. And so they're speaking from the only experiences that they've had, and that has been in a facility or with families who were all very similar to them. And there is that recognition that there is a bond between families who can support each other because they understand some of the same feelings. But that's a support level to me rather than an intervention level. So to answer your question, I would look at other states and programs who have already made that move and have promoted not using facilities that are primarily or only for families with children with disabilities, and look at how did they go about doing it. Some of them may have just simply said, we're not going to fund these anymore, and some of them may have had some, you know, alternate steps of how did they help move into the natural environment. I think you also have to help your providers learn about the evidence that supports more inclusive and more natural environments information. And there is a growing body of evidence. In fact, there's, in, you know, my piles on my desk are much higher in the natural environments, least restrictive environments pile that shows efficacy than in the pile that shows single pull-out, discipline-oriented services. And so I think that it's a combination approach. What are the ways that we can push forward and limit anything that is not natural environments, least restrictive environments, but also how do we help convince those guys it's going to work? And it's often fear speaking. It's not something your providers know how to do or feel comfortable doing. And for some people, the more they are unsure of change or uncomfortable taking risks with change, the louder their voices get and the deeper their heels get planted in. A couple of good experiences will help them nudge them along. And so it's how do you help them pair up with someone that can help support them to have a good experience that I would encourage you to look for is, you know, can we try to catch kids being good and reinforce them? So I guess we're looking at now how can we help providers be good and see how they can get there and giving them some resources and supports, giving them a colleague to work with or another program to work with that's going to help them see how they got there and how they did it. And I'm sure that there are many examples of places that you could join up with, and I'm sure Joycey and Linda can help you with some state information about how other states have moved forward with this. But recognize those are adults in your care in your service providers who are unsure of what they're supposed to do, and so the way they're responding is by refusing to do anything. That's a defense mechanism, and that's an adult learning style we got to work with. I don't know if that even came close to giving you an answer, but I would look for other states and other programs and what they did and try to get some training down to the providers in a meaningful way to them that they could then see that it does work. Okay?
Okay, thank you.
Julianne, I think that's all the time we have for questions.